Hi, I'm Rabbi Andrea Weiss, and you're listening to Drinking and Drashing Torah with a Twist with our two amazing HUC students, Amanda Weiss and Gabe Snyder.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I'm so excited that you're here.
Why? Why? What? Is everything okay?
Yeah, everything's fine, but for the past two episodes, I've missed you.
Oh, well, I've missed being here. It's really nice to be back.
Especially because we have such cool guests on today.
Oh, I am so excited for our guests.
Yeah. Do you think our listeners will be excited about their surprise?
I mean, maybe. I guess we'll find out.
Everyone loves a gift, right?
Are we getting presents?
We're definitely getting some sort of presents. And our listeners, we hope you're excited about it. Let's get started. It's true that last week's episode might have been bringing in a new book, but guess what? Today, we get gifts. And don't get me wrong, it's not just presents, but I have an actual presence with me today. The presence of co-host Gabe Snyder, the presence of executive producer Edan Waldman. Y'all, it's not just an episode with me, but guess what? If that weren't enough, we have two incredible rabbis on with us today as well. We are so, so excited and so thrilled and so privileged to have the presence, the gifts of Rabbi Andrea Weiss and Rabbi Rachel Pass. Rabbi Andrea L. Weiss, PhD, is Jack Joseph and Morton Mandel Provost and Associate Professor of Bible at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. She received a BA in English from the University of California at Berkeley in 1987 and was ordained at the Hebrew Union College in New York in 1993. She earned her doctoral degree in 2004 from the University of Pennsylvania, Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. She's the founder of the American Values Religious Voices Campaign, co-editor of American Values Religious Voices 100 Days, 100 Letters, University of Cincinnati Press, 2019, with Volume 2 forthcoming in Fall 2022. Get excited! And associate editor of The Torah, a Women's Commentary, CCAR Press, 2008, which won the Jewish Book Council's 2009 Everett Family Foundation Jewish Book of the Year Award. She has written figurative language and biblical prose narrative, metaphor in the Book of Samuel, Brill 2006, and numerous articles focused on metaphor, biblical poetry, Psalms, and the prophets. Her current research focuses on an in-depth study of biblical metaphors for God entitled God in the Biblical Imagination, The Mechanics and Theology of Metaphor. She lives in the Philadelphia suburbs with her husband, Alan Taubert, and their dog, Jordy. They are the proud parents of their young adult children, Rebecca and Elon. And believe it or not, she also teaches a class or a few classes sometimes at HUCJR and helped teach me teaching Bible to adults. So for those people who are listening in wondering how I can do this so well, partially it's because of her. So we're really excited to welcome Rabbi Andrea Weiss and Rabbi Rachel Pass to the show. Welcome to Drinking and Drashing, Torah with a Twist.
I'm so glad to be here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's really a pleasure to be on Zoom with you. And I'm so, so thrilled to not be on my own this week, even though I loved my Wonder Woman episode last week. And so welcome back, Gabe Snyder. The crowd is going to be thrilled to have you back for your Torah rundown and for Midrashic Mixology this week. How's it going?
It's good, Amanda. How are you doing?
I am thrilled. I'm really, truly excited to get into the gifts of Nesso, but it wouldn't be, you know, the same if we didn't have the gifts of our incredible executive producer. How's it going, Edan Waldman?
It's going great. Excited to be back.
Right? It's so nice to have the fam back together. But speaking of presents, I feel like we should be present for the conversation that's about to come up soon. And so let's get started. Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
You know, you have a birthday coming up.
I do have a birthday coming up. This is true.
Have you been thinking about anything that you might be interested in?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. It's really just been one thing to the next, and haven't really had time to think about gifts much.
Well, I would say, you know, generally the best gifts are kind of just a short, sweet, small thing.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
Like something distilled, maybe.
Oh, you mean like a distilled Parsha summary?
I did mean that. Do you have one for us this week?
I might. This book is called Numbers, so here are some numbers. We're counting Gershonites, Merarites, and Kohathites, each between the ages of 30 and 50, specifically those who are obligated to service in the Mishkan. There are 2,630 Gershonite men, age 30 to 50, and they're in charge of carrying the cloth objects related to the tent, including my favorite dolphin skins. The Merarite men, numbering 3,200, are in charge of the planks, bars, posts, sockets, pegs, and cords. The 2,750 Kohathite men are in charge of the Ark, the Table of Showbread, and the Menorah. Overall, that's 8,580 Levites obligated to service. I'm sure that's the end of all the numbers in the Book of Numbers. On another note entirely, people with bodily discharge or who have touched a corpse go outside of the camp. Also, when people do something that hurts another person, they should feel guilty about that and confess their crime. They then need to make restitution to the person harmed, the value of their loss, plus one-fifth. If the person is dead, then that part goes to the priests. Then we get a lie detector ritual for women who may or may not have committed adultery. If a man thinks his wife committed adultery but she denies it, he can bring his wife to the priest with an offering, and the priest performs a ritual with water and earth and the offering. The priest curses the wife and she's required to say Amen, Amen, and then she drinks the Me Hamarim Hamearim, the bitter curse water. If she's lying, the mud makes her sick, but if it doesn't, then she's not a witch, I mean adulteress. Then we learn about the Nazirite vow. What's a Nazirite vow? A person can set themselves apart from the community in service to God. They abstain from wine and grapes, and they don't cut their hair, kind of like Samson, but not really, because he never actually made a Nazirite vow, it just kind of got pushed on him. Maybe Regina Spector can explain. Now that we've gotten sufficiently off topic, what do Nazirites do? They're required to remain ritually pure even if a close family member dies. If they become impure accidentally, then they have to shave their heads and make a special offering. There's a whole ritual for completing a term of service as a Nazirite, including offerings and wine and shaving of hair. Then we get the most ancient blessing of our tradition. May the Eternal One bless you and protect you. May the Eternal One deal kindly and graciously with you. May the Eternal One bestow divine favor for you and grant you peace. So the Mishkan is finally consecrated and all of the chieftains or princes or whatever are making dedication offerings. Their first was the chief of Judah, Nachshon ben Aminadav. I think there might be a song about him. Following Nachshon, Netanel ben Suar of Issachar, Eliav ben Cholon of Zebulun, Elitzur ben Shedayur of Reuben, Shelumiel ben Tzuri Shaddai of Simeon, Eliasaf ben Deuel of Gad, Elishama ben Amihud of Ephraim, Gamliel ben Pedatsur of Menashe, Abidan ben Gidoni of Benjamin, Achiezer ben Amishadai of Dan, Pagiel ben Ochran of Asher, and Achira ben Enan of Naphtali. Names are fun. In all, the offering included 12 silver bowls, 12 silver basins, which are somehow different from bowls, 24 bulls, 60 rams, 60 lambs, 60 goats, and 12 gold ladles filled with incense. I really love all the counting in this book. And that's Parashat Naso.
That was impressive.
I will say, the reference to Regina Spector there was my favorite part. That song, Samson, is the only one that I can still play on piano after 15 plus years of lessons. So love that little sneaky reference in there.
Thank you. I do try to bring in as many pop culture references as I can just to keep people on their toes.
Definitely still on my toes.
Thanks.
Rabbi Dr. Weiss, as one of your students and a rising fifth year at HUCJR, I've gotten to see a lot of your work over the last few years, whether it's been spending time with you in Jerusalem, whether it's been exploring Bible and in our different ways and simplicity, or digging deep into Drash for our Torah and our Bible. And of all of the parshas that you could have picked, you picked Naso. Why?
Well, Naso, I picked because I have a special connection to this parsha. This was the parsha that my daughter read on her bat mitzvah. And its significance, actually, so her bat mitzvah was in June of 2011. But the significance of the parsha goes back to 2007 when Dr. Tamara Eskenazi and I were in the final months of editing the Torah, a Women's Commentary. And that summer, my daughter, who was almost 10, was off at summer camp for the first time, and we were painting her room. And when we moved her bed to paint her room, we found a legal pad that had a story about a girl and her mom. And the description of the mom was, "My mom, Toni, is always working and going on trips, and I never see much of her. And when she's home, she's always grumpy." So I took a breath, put it down, went to my computer, and I wrote an email to Tamara Eskenazi and Rabbi Hare Person, and the subject line was the hidden costs of the commentary. And I shared this story and talked about sort of we were all experiencing in different ways the toll that that project was taking on us. And Tamara Eskenazi wrote me back the next day, and I found the email, so I'm going to read from it. She said, "You can take comfort in knowing how proud your daughter is going to be that her mother also mothered such a historic project. When she becomes a bat mitzvah, and not only she, but all the kids in her class resort to this commentary that her mother produced. Moreover," she wrote, "she will also grow, as did my daughters, assuming that women have fulfilling lives, even as mothers, and that education is the norm." So that was July of 2007. And then 4 years later, when it was my daughter's parsha, was not so. So, of course, the bit of the parsha that interested her was the ritual of this woman accused of adultery. And, of course, the source that she went to and quoted from in her Devar Torah was Dr. Amy Kalmanovsky's commentary from the Torah Women's Commentary, which she quoted from, and that helped her understand what was going on with this ritual. And after she was finished, I sent Dr. Tamara Eskenazi Rebecca's Devar Torah plus Tamara's email from 4 years before and told her that she was prophetic in the fact that my daughter would, in fact, use the Torah Women's Commentary on her bat mitzvah. So, and the other story I'll tell about it is that in the midst of my daughter giving her Devar Torah and wrestling with what does it mean, this ritual for a woman accused of adultery, and my son, he was little at the time, he was 7, and he leaned over and he said, "Mom, what's adultery?" I said, "I'll explain to you later." So that's my not-so connection.
That is such a fantastic story on so many different levels, not the least of which is that, you know, I imagine myself learning with this book. I imagine, you know, our first Torah class at HUC in Jerusalem used the Torah, a women's commentary, as our text. And to know that even when it was being produced, even when it was being compiled and translated and like really put together, the thought was being put into it of, for whom are we producing this work? So I'm curious if that was always the intention, if from the beginning you set out to produce a Torah commentary that would be used by B'nai Mitzvah students, that would be used by seminary students. Who was the target audience of the Torah, a women's commentary?
So when we were working on the book, we saw our target audience as contemporary Jewish women. Those words, each of which is significant, contemporary meaning that we wanted the book to address contemporary issues, Jewish in that these were all our contributors were Jewish, a Jewish look at the Torah using Jewish sources from the earliest sources on, and women, that the book would be written all by women and also would address issues of women and pay close attention to female characters in the Bible. Like, for example, in this parsha, both the woman accused of adultery, and if you just even compare the amount of space that the Torah Women's Commentary spends on that part of the parasha compared to other sections, also highlights the section on the Nazir where women have been Nazirites, both biblically women and making vows, and also in rabbinic texts as well, evidence of women as Nazirites.
I think that's a really interesting point and question that Gabe asked. And for me, I always try to bring in some lines of Torah whenever we talk about our portions. And one that's been sticking out to me a lot is this line from Numbers 4:49, which says, "Al pi Adonai pakadotam biyad Moshe ish ish al avadato ve'al masa'o." I'm going to gender neutral it for myself, but that every person was noted or was really like seen for their service, you know, for the work that they were doing, and also for the tribute that they were giving. And I think that that's a really powerful piece, especially when last week for Bamidbar, we were discussing this idea of people being left out of the counting. Here, there's something really special about each person being recognized for the work that they're doing and the gifts that they've brought forth. And as somebody who deals with, I would argue, people who have unique gifts on a regular basis, how do you make sure that each gift is recognized, each person is seen for the work that they're doing, especially when those gifts might look so different?
So Amanda, I was also kind of noted that line as well, and the fact that the way in which this Parsha sees that different people have different roles. So we get to explicitly bringing gifts, and the gifts at the end of the Parsha are all the same. But at the beginning, each of the Levite clans each play a different role. And I was thinking about similar along the lines that you were thinking as well, but about the Parsha shows that people have different skills, different capacities, and that the way in which people in different roles each play a part in this collective endeavor of creating sacred community.
And with the work that you're doing in terms of helping create and train and mentor, you know, emerging Jewish leaders, what are the insights from this Torah portion that help lead you in those endeavors? I mean, you work really hard to ensure that Judaism is vibrant throughout not only the country, but I would say throughout the world.
So I think part of that is helping create a school in which each student can be seen for the gifts that they bring through their studies and their other experiences while at Hebrew Union College, that each student is being nurtured and grows in a way that's unique to them. People come with different gifts and with different strengths, different weaknesses. And are we creating the atmosphere in which every student can grow and thrive? And what does that take, and what kind of support do different students need to grow into the leaders and the scholars that bring them to HUC?
So you have this really wonderful program where I know in my own class alone, we have so many different points of view and life experiences, and we all come together and we get to share those gifts with each other, in addition to like learning from our professors and learning from like the incredible faculty that you've helped to curate at this institution. I'm curious as to how you see not only like where these people are coming from and those gifts coming in, but what you see as the outcome in terms of what gifts HUC specifically brings to the table that kind of transforms these students with their individual gifts to serve the Jewish people.
So as we were asking the question, I was thinking about the phrase that's used to take a census, which we have at the beginning of the Parsha, Naso et Rosh, to lift up the head. I don't know if you discussed this in an earlier episode where we've had census, but that idea of lifting up, and it strikes me that that's also connected. We see toward the end of the Parsha and the priestly blessing also, Ya'er Adonai Panav Elecha, that God shines God's face, and or Yisa Adonai Panav Elecha, that God also lifts up God's face. And so what does it mean to kind of help every student shine? And what is the kind of both content knowledge that students need to develop into the Jewish professionals and the scholars that they're becoming? What are the work experiences? What is the kind of spiritual growth that students want to make sure that students have so that they can blossom into Jewish leaders, be it cantors, rabbis, educators, Jewish communal leaders, scholars? I think that's it both. And the nature of our program also allows that kind of individual attention to help each student grow and thrive.
It's really fascinating talking about tensions, because I think that this Torah portion specifically has a lot of them. It goes, you know, positive, negative, neutral, positive, negative, negative, positive. You know, I feel like I'm in a David Melech song, like, you know, in a bridge of just going back and forth of opposites. But one of the things that is difficult is, you know, you go from a woman who goes through trial by bitterness, right? You know, in terms of whether or not she's committed adultery, to a Nazirite who is giving these vows and meant to be, right, like Kiddushin, like almost meant to be set apart to be a holy people. And it shows, I think, that even when we come together for the great party, it's almost like we're doing a birthday party for the priest and for God, and we're giving all these gifts at the end, but that the people that make up the party are so different. And I constantly think about Torah as trying to show what a holy community can look like in a difficult world, in a realistic world. But here, I find it fascinating that, you know, we have everything from incredible gift giving and counting and holy tabernacle holding to trials not by fire, but by bitter waters, which, you know, reminds me a little bit of Moses and the golden calf when he made the people drink the not so delicious water with all of the golden calf bits in it. To sacred Nazarites who are taking vows to be, you know, essentially set apart as really incredible members of the community. And I think about this a lot in terms of the different clergy that come out and what it looks like in terms of how we can have this incredible holy community where everybody is just so different, trying to do a similar thing of making Judaism come alive for people. And what does that look like for you? Like, how do you make Judaism come alive for you when you are, I would say, being a rabbi to so many different constituencies?
I think for me, sort of where Judaism comes alive is in part in taking these ancient texts and finding new meaning in them. So as a teacher of Torah and as a Bible scholar, that sort of continually uncovering new layers of meaning in this really ancient text and figuring out how to connect them to our contemporary world. So for example, as I was in preparation for the podcast, as I was doing a deep dive into this parsha, and I was thinking about the Sotan a different way, you know, how we read Torah also really reads us. So, you know, at its core, with the woman accused of adultery, we have her husband who has this fit of jealousy and is suspicious that his wife has committed adultery. And I started thinking about anxiety and how pervasive anxiety is in our world today, reading a lot about young teens and anxiety, where I'm sure everyone on this podcast is experiencing anxiety. We see this just all around us. And so what does it mean to, and I'm thinking about that fit of jealousy as a form of anxiety. And here in this case, we have this ritual as a way to try to figure out that the husband is anxious, feeling that his wife may have committed adultery. And here this ritual to try to figure out, is that anxiety rooted in reality or not? And so the chapter is complicated in a lot of other ways and problematic. But that idea, if that was a new way to think about this problematic, really bizarre, anxious ritual and connecting it to what we're all feeling now, which is this feeling of anxiety of what, when you, you know, how do you handle when you think something bad may or may not have happened? And what can we learn from that part of the parsha that might help us, as so many people today, I think, are dealing with a heightened level of anxiety than they dealt with before?
I'm very interested in the idea that this is this fit of jealousy by the husband can be sort of translated to the idea of anxiety. And what do you think about the fact that, like, in this, the fact finding or sort of the reality check has to take place on a woman's body very violently? And what does that sort of mean in today's world, you know, taking the Bible and turning it contemporary like you so incredibly do? Like, how do you, I don't have a good way of formulating this question, like, how do you look at that, like, extend that metaphor onto this violence?
I couldn't extend it that far. I mean, like I said, it doesn't take away sort of thinking about that first part as to what prompts this ritual doesn't then take away all the other problematic parts of it. The idea that the husband has all the power, that this ritual is inflicted upon the wife, and there's debate about whether it's really, in some ways, can it be seen as protecting her? In fact, it's giving her a way to, in some sense, prove that she's not guilty. So that trying to find contemporary meaning, the metaphor can extend throughout the whole ritual or kind of take away what's problematic about the ritual, particularly for contemporary readers and contemporary women reading this who see this as the negative aspects of this.
I think for me, one of the things that I find really phenomenal about this is inherently our Torah portion genuinely comes to a place where it says, God bless this mess, right? That there's a lot of things that are happening in our society, things that are difficult, things that we struggle with, things that are not okay. And in some way, we come to a place where we're able to say to Aaron and his sons, we're in number 6, right? We're looking at number 6, 23 through 26. And we have this moment where all of the people of Israel, including the woman who is, you know, the Sota and possibly has committed adultery, including the Nazarites, including the people who might be struggling or have sinned and needed to come out and confess, including the people who are bringing forth their gifts. This mess of a community that we're able to say, Yevarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, may God bless you and keep you. It's a pretty great message. In fact, it's such a great message that we continuously bring it forward in our most important moments. And so we know that we could continue down this line of questioning, but this is really the message that I think Nessa wants us to hear. And Rabbi Weiss, if you had a message that you wanted our listeners to hear, if you had something that you were really excited for listeners to know or feel or do after listening to this episode, what would that message be? What would it sound like?
So I want to answer that question by going back to what we talked about earlier about the way that the parasha begins with each of the Levites who have a role, and then at the end with the bringing of the gifts. And I think that question for each of us to ask, what are the gifts that we have and how do we want to bring those gifts to the world? So that's something I think about that we draw from this parsha about what it means to serve and the way that there are different ways in which people can serve and create sacred community. And we see that in this parsha. And I think another powerful message from this parsha is about blessing and about the way in which in the priestly blessing, blessings flow from God paying attention to us, lifting God's face, looking upon us kindly, and that that's when blessings flow. I think the lesson for us in that and the way in which when we pay attention to, particularly in a world in which we are often distracted, and if you think about how often people are looking down on their phones and not even looking at each other, and the way in which blessings come from being present for other people and really paying attention to other people. And that's when blessings and well-being can flow from that. So those are some of the larger lessons I take from the parsha.
There's only a small group of people who can say this, but I have gotten to experience Rabbi Rachel Pass in so many different places and spaces that have been in person or digital, and so I just want to name a few. I've hung out with Rabbi Rachel Pass at HEC's Soup Kitchen. Go donate. We'll make sure there's a link in the show notes. I've hung out with Rabbi Rachel Pass at Prospect Park when I first got my puppy, Takiya. In fact, I have a great picture of Rachel holding Takiya. I have hung out with Rachel Pass on countless Zoom minion services, like in order to honor and support our faculty. I've hung out with Rachel Pass just in the hallways and libraries and stacks of HEC. And tonight, I get to hang out with Rabbi Rachel Pass just this one more time, although I'm sure I'll see her somewhere else in Prospect Park. But I'm really excited to be able to welcome her to be able to take over the show, which is so exciting. But just in case you aren't as lucky to get to hang out with Rachel as often as I have, let me tell you a little about her. Rachel Pass is a queer, feminist, Brooklyn-based rabbi. She was ordained from Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in 2021 and has a BA in Psychology and Near Eastern and Judaic Studies from Brandeis University. Rabbi Pass has written extensively on Jewish views of abortion, creative Jewish rituals including reclaiming mikveh, the ritual bath, and feminist Jewish thought and theology. She is passionate about intersectional feminism, her dog Nipsey, who's super cute, heads up, and reading as many books as she can get her hands on. This is true. Check out her Goodreads. Get excited. Rachel, you get to take over this show for the next 10 minutes. Get stoked.
I'm so stoked to be here with the person who ordained me a year ago and change. And I really want to turn us back to the Sota, to the woman accused of adultery. Obviously, this is a sticky piece of text to read. And I sort of have two questions, two places that I want to go with this. Rabbi Weiss, you were starting when you were telling us about your daughter's bat mitzvah and about the creation of the women's commentary, a Torah, the women's commentary, in which you edited the Torah. You were talking about the process of writing that book and editing that book. And I was really struck by looking at the Sota and the ritual of the Sota that we get later on in Talmud is that the bitter waters are the waters that the woman has to drink to prove her guilt or innocence is from letters on paper, and that we take a scroll of text soak it in water, and then she drinks the ink water that comes out of that. And that juxtaposition there of that ink water and you writing this incredible book, that really sort of taking back that power of writing and about words. And so I wanted to ask you about sort of that juxtaposition and how you see that in this parsha and in your life.
So one of them, I like that image of sort of what it means to create words versus having them imagining the words dissolve on paper. And I felt incredibly privileged to be able to have the role that I had as associate editor of the Torah Women's Commentary and working with my teacher, Dr. Rabbi Tamara Eskenazi, and to create this opportunity for this wide range of Jewish women to be able to be commentators on Torah, both trying to figure out what the heck is the biblical text saying in this case, which my colleague, Rabbi Dr. Amy Kalmanovsky, does beautifully to try to figure out what is the historical context, what's actually going on, how do we read and understand this text in its biblical context, to looking at other scholars who look at this passage in a rabbinic context, the way in which the rabbis, in a sense, sort of make it nearly impossible to actually carry out this ritual. And then another section of this parsha where Rabbi Lisa Grishkow shares her scholarship on this and really getting at the bigger question of what do we do with troubling texts like this? What are different ways in which we as contemporary readers wrestle with a really disturbing chapter like this, where a woman is made to undergo this ritual? So putting ink on paper and allowing all of these remarkable Jewish women, giving them the platform to not just to write words, but to be commentators of Torah, is really powerful and really important.
Yeah, I just can't get over sort of that juxtaposition and the power of like being able to reclaim the words and putting them back on paper, and then having your daughter be able to read them and share them in such a powerful way. And we just hit the 100th anniversary of the first ever bat mitzvah. And we also just hit the 50th anniversary of the first ordained by a religious institution woman rabbi in the U.S. And you get to be the person who does the ordaining. And this is sort of moving us away from the sota, but I would love to know what that experience is like as, you know, a woman with a daughter observing all of these anniversaries and being the conduit to creating more women rabbis, non-binary clergy, women cantors also, and, you know, clergy in general, and how you see sort of these anniversaries in this history sort of play out in that experience.
Yeah, it's been very meaningful this spring as we've marked the 50th anniversary of the ordination of Rabbi Sally Prizan, both to hear her speak a number of times about that. And what's been powerful for me has also been through the work of Pamela Nadell and Rabbi Shirley Adelson also, who's looked into some of the women who would be rabbis and the early women rabbis, and this not just 50-year history, but really 100-year history of women studying Torah, wanting to become rabbis, and what it means to be part of that legacy, which I'm part of, which you're part of, which Amanda and Gabe are part of also. And in this parsha, Naso, we have the priestly blessing. So for me to be able to, in my role, have the immense privilege of standing before the Ark and be able to bless our new clergy ordained, those who feel called to become HUC ordained cantors and rabbis, and reciting those very ancient words and very much feeling like a conduit for all and sort of feeling the weight of that history and the weight of the responsibility of what it means to be engaged in Avodat HaKodesh, to be committed to this life of service, serving God and the Jewish people as rabbis and cantors. And it's very powerful to be up there and for me to feel both how old and powerful and sacred the words of the priestly blessing are, and also this long legacy going back to the Torah of serving God and the Jewish people, which we see in this week's parsha. We're starting with the Levites and in these very concrete ways in which they are schlepping and caring, they're serving God and the Jewish people. And so as I have the opportunity to ordain the rabbis and cantors, they're in different ways doing the same thing, which is creating sacred community, making sure that our communities can thrive and that we're creating sacred space for Judaism to thrive into the 21st century. So it's a long span of time and to be part of this chain of tradition.
This is making me think of something that I was looking at your page on the HUC directory before this, and I noticed something that I didn't know about, which is that you're in the process of co-authoring a book with Jason Kalman, By Women, About Women, For Women, A New Torah Commentary for a New Millennium, on the 100th anniversary of Women of Reformed Judaism. What is that? And can you tell us a little bit about that project?
So that's an article that we wrote with my colleague in Cincinnati, Dr. Jason Kalman. It was part of the centennial volume for the anniversary of Women of Reformed Judaism. And what was exciting about that project was that it created an opportunity to collect as much archival material as we could to put in the American Jewish Archives at HUC in Cincinnati. So I reached out to everyone who was involved in the early stages of the Torah Women's Commentary, and we were able to gather as many papers and other documents as we could to create an archive so that people for generations to come who want to study the Torah Women's Commentary can have some archival material. So I had a bunch of paper, other people, and in writing the article together, and we put the creation of the Torah Women's Commentary in this broader history of women in the rabbinate, women scholars, Jewish feminism, sort of situated it historically, and we're able to chronicle the history of how the commentary came about.
So another project that you've done that you work on that I find particularly valuable in making religion contemporary is the American Values Religious Voices Project. Could you tell us just like a couple of sentences of what that project is and then a little bit about American values and bringing together all of these different voices for that?
Thank you, Rachel, for asking about that. This is a passion project of mine that was an unexpected sort of new chapter of my career in the days following the 2016 election. And when I, like a lot of other people, was figuring out, okay, now what? And what do I feel called to do given the results of the election? And throughout the campaign, I had seen how so many of the American values that I had long taken for granted all of a sudden were called into question, if not seemed to be overturned. And I had thought about the way so many of those core American values are related to our religious traditions. This gets back to what we were talking about earlier, the way in which our sacred texts shed meaning and connect to our contemporary world. And so I had the idea, what if we could get 100 scholars of religion who would each write a letter, and we would send one letter a day for the first 100 days of the Trump administration to the president, vice president, and members of Congress. And I paired up with a friend of mine who's a graphic designer, Lisa Weinberger, and we created this project with a website and social media, and we made the project happen, and it was eventually published as a book, American Values, Religious Voices, 100 Days, 100 Letters, and had succeeded in a way that I hadn't anticipated. The project definitely, both for those who wrote the letters and those who read the letters, we had subscribers who got the letters every day, just found it really meaningful and as a way to help make sense of the world that we were suddenly in, and also were really moved by seeing and learning from other religious traditions and the way that scholars of religion were connecting these ancient sacred texts to the really important contemporary issues that we were dealing with in those early months of 2017. And so with the publication of the book, I thought the project was over, but then we had our most recent election, and as in the days what we were waiting out the results of the 2020 election, decided to revive the project, which I did with the help of my daughter and a few of her friends and my friend Lisa again. And we made the project happen again, this time with the letters addressed to President Biden, Vice President Harris, and members of Congress. And again, sent letters from a very diverse group of scholars of religion writing about contemporary issues and connecting them to sacred texts.
I have many more things that I would love to talk to you about American Values Religious Voices. And unfortunately, I'm getting our message from our hosts telling me that it is time to wrap up this section. So I just want to say thank you for chatting with me a little bit.
Turned it on Rachel and ask, Amanda had asked earlier sort of what the bigger message of the Parsha is. And so since you have also been thinking about this Parsha in preparation for today, what are some of the bigger messages that you draw from the Parsha?
I have been thinking about that in terms of sort of two things. One is that this Parsha contains a lot of magic. Like, it seems to be to me, just like straight up witchcraft. We have this Sota ritual in which we put a woman up like on stage in front of everybody and we make her drink these liquids. And if her body reacts in a certain way, then she's innocent. And if not, then she's guilty. If that's not magic, I don't know what is. And also the priestly blessing as sort of a tripartite blessing also has roots in sort of the magic idea of the rule of threes. And so that's, I'll say that's actually sort of the Nechemta piece, which I put in a little bit early, sort of the more positive piece of this parsha. The other thing that I really pull from this, and this is from Rabbanit Leah Sarna, who sort of inspired this idea in me, that the Sota ritual is perhaps an abortion ritual, and that we can look at this, and sort of what I was getting to with the question of jealousy or anxiety earlier was, like, what happens when one person's anxiety on another person's body forces pregnancy or forces abortion, and how that's similar and also somewhat opposite to what we're seeing in the news today with the overturning of Roe v. Wade impending. Those are my takeaways from this parsha. Thanks for asking.
That's a good example of turn it and turn it again and everything's in it.
In honor of the Mei Hamarim Hame'arim, the bitter curse water that the priests use as a witch hunt-esque lie detector test in the ritual of the Sota, we wanted to bring something a little sweeter and a little more appropriate for these hot summer days. So for this week on Midrashic Mixology, we present to you the Cursed Mudslide. Start by rimming the glass in some dirt, or in this case, cinnamon sugar. Gently wet the rim of your glass with a drop of Kahlua, you might know where this is going already, and dip the rim into cinnamon sugar to coat. Drizzle in some chocolate syrup, and we're ready to make the drink. In a blender, we're starting with 1 ounce of the aforementioned Kahlua, because coffee grounds look kind of like dirt. What else is in the priestly recipe? Flour. For our grain stand-in, we're using a grain-based vodka. 1 ounce of that plus 1 ounce of Irish cream. Hey Gabe, why are we using a blender? Because we're adding in 3 scoops of vanilla ice cream, because purity is an important part of this whole thing. Finally, add in a pinch of cinnamon for the priest's curse, because the secret ingredient is always cinnamon. Blend it all together and pour into your prepared vessel. For all our Nazarite friends who need a non-alcoholic option, swap out the booze for a shot of espresso and 1 ounce of milk. Garnish with a pinch of dirt, I mean cinnamon, say amen, amen, and enjoy. Make one for you, one for your clergy person, and even one for your spouse. Drink responsibly, we wouldn't want this one to make you sick. That's a bad joke. And as always, l'chaim.
Amen, amen.
Very creative.
Gabe, I know I talked before about God blessing this mess, but that mudslide, man, I mean, hey, whew, we'll see what type of mess that might bring us. Having said all of this, I know our crowd is so happy that you were back for Midrashic Mixology, and I am happy slash sad slash, I guess you would say it's bittersweet to say that we've hit our final section of thank yous and closing cues. And so, Rabbi Dr. Andrea Weiss, Rabbi Rachel Pass, Gabe, Edan, even though I just told Edan he didn't need to answer the question, but guess what? He's going to answer the question. In Nesso, we learned that each person has a gift to give, and I know that we've talked about that a lot. Even if they look quite similar to the ones that have been given before, how can we keep our gifts new, even when we're looking to Torah or traditional or even ancient values? How are we able to keep bringing our own individual spin, our own lift, our own tribute to each time we give it forward or pay it forward? Rabbi Weiss, we'll start with you.
I want to answer the question, which I think is, as I thought about the question, how do we each take care of ourselves so that we can best give the gifts that we each have to bring?
I think that that's a really difficult question to sometimes ask ourselves, an important one, especially for those of us, you know, I know you talked about anxiety earlier, but I would say that anxiety is often paired with a lot of self-criticism. So remembering that we, in fact, actually have gifts to bring and then trying to figure out what those are is a really great starting place. Rabbi Pass.
I also just want to say to Rabbi Weiss that that brings me back to what you said at the very, very beginning with this story about your daughter on the legal pad, right? Of prioritizing different gifts at different time or giving gifts to two big things at once. I think my quick answer is that we are new every time we revisit any gift, any text, anything. And that, you know, I can come to the ritual of the Sota angry. I could come to the ritual of the Sota curious. And there will be something new each time because I'll be new each time.
You know, and I think that's a really important aspect of our presence. I certainly made enough jokes or puns over this idea of presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S, and presence with a C-E at the end, that our presence and who we are, and sometimes even when we are, really matters when we're coming to our Torah portions because they speak to us differently each time. Sometimes they may not hit at all. Sometimes they hit so deeply that it hurts. And sometimes it, you know, it makes you laugh, especially when you try to figure out how we're making ice cream come out. But speaking of ice cream and flavor, Gabe, what's your take on this?
I think that tradition isn't a limiting factor. I think that tradition should never be something that you look at and say, oh, well, what I'm doing is just what's been before me. It's just old and, you know, worn out. I don't think tradition is our gift. I think tradition is the lens through which we channel our gifts. If you just give somebody a piece of paper and say, start writing, that's going to be a really difficult task. But if you say, here's a piece of paper, and I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and then they start writing, that's going to make something much more directed and much more coherent. So I would say that don't worry that your gift is something old. Make it a part of you and use tradition as a way to shape what you're doing to bring your gift into the world.
I really appreciate that because I think the gifts that we get from asking questions are often underrated. The fact is, it's really difficult to figure out what people want to get and maybe sometimes what we want to give. Idan, speaking of, you know, being present and wanting to give, what answer are you interested in giving this evening? And thank you for speaking even after I said you might not need to.
It's all right. Well, the first thought I had hearing the question was that gifts to give very often are at their core, just a general core value. And there's always a quote unquote, like modern interpretation or spin to adapt the gift to the times. I don't think it's really possible for anything to be completely outdated in regards to things that you can give. So whether that be, you know, you want to just be able to help and teach people that the way that that manifests back when, you know, that was first intended to be a Jewish value is very different than how, you know, that might manifest now, whether that just be being a teacher in a school or offering anybody who needs tech assistance, you know, that obviously no one was going to offer anyone tech assistance thousands of years ago, because what does that even mean then, right? But that's still at its core the same value, the same gift to give.
Absolutely. I like to think the idea of tech assistance just looked a little different, like tabernacle assistance maybe. You know, that technically they were just opening different tabs at that point, right? Bad joke, but it was there. I think that I love gift giving. It's something that I take really seriously because I always do look to the past about what people might be interested in taking on or what might be meaningful to them in the moment. But I think that realistically, it's difficult sometimes to look at our past to figure out what's going to come forward when our eyes are so focused forward or so focused, you know, backward or past. And I think that when we're able to do what our incredible rabbis have suggested we do, which is come to our portions, come to our tradition with fresh eyes, with fresh perspectives, we're able to find a really beautiful blend that creates in itself a presence that becomes a gift. And I think that generally that's really important when we're trying to create a lineage of gift givers, when we have an ability to transmit these gifts onto other people and the ability to make Judaism such a powerful presence in our life. But we're not done yet. Andrea, it seems like you have one more thing to add.
Well, I've been thinking, Amanda, about your connection between presence and presence. And that made me think about the priestly blessing, which we talked about earlier, being about how blessings flow when we pay attention. And in this regard, this is a bit of Torah that I've learned from my husband, who's probably the world's best gift giver. And that's because he pays attention. and he sees, he really watches what people want and often really gives people what they want. And so I think good gifts flow from paying attention, just as blessings flow from paying attention. So I think you're really on the mark in the connection that you're making between presence and presence.
I appreciate that. And I also think the Torah is on the mark too. And it talks about work and tribute, right? This idea of the things that we're doing in reality, but also like Masav, when we're talking about these things that we lift up, right? The things that become really special in our eyes. All of these are important conversations, and we know that people get really excited about, yes, gifts, but also about the way that they can lift up their own Torah. And so for people that might be interested in continuing this journey of lifting up Torah or interested in continuing a conversation, how might they be able to do so? Rabbi Weiss, we'll start with you.
Well, people can take a look at the huc.edu, especially anyone who's interested in being a Jewish leader. And also, if you're interested in taking a look at the Values and Voices letters, you can take a look at that at valuesandvoices.com.
Incredible. Especially if you want to buy the book as a gift, I'm sure many people would appreciate it. I know I would. Just a heads up to anybody that's listening.
I did receive my copy of the book as a gift, in fact.
I love it. Rabbi Rachel Pass, how could people find or follow you if they want to continue learning from you?
Best way to find and contact me is at rachelpass.com, rachelpass.com.
Incredible. I am so grateful that both of you were able to find and make the time to be present with us this evening and to be able to talk about a portion that, as I've said before, I think often gets overlooked because there's so much going on in it. In fact, there was so much going on that we didn't even get to everything within it today. But realistically, pay attention to what's happening out there because you'll find leaders like Rabbi Weiss, like Rabbi Pass out there making Torah come alive with every major moment that's happening. And there are a lot of them if we're just willing to look and pay attention and be present in that moment. Thank you so much to Gabe for being an incredible co-host and taking on Midrashic Mixology, because clearly my math-based one didn't meet the mark. It got maybe a low passing grade. And thank you, of course, to Idan Waldman that made sure our audio was on point this week. And thank you, as always, to Kate, who makes us all sound brilliant, and to our listeners who cause us and inspire us to be brilliant. We're so excited that you were with us today, and we hope you'll listen for our conclusion coming your way soon.
Hey, Amanda.
What's up, Gabe?
This was a really interesting conversation, or like sets of conversations. I particularly am interested in the conversations that we had around the ritual of the sota.
Yeah, say more.
Okay, so I've always thought about this ritual as like, you know, the witch hunt thing of like throw her in a river and see if she floats or whatever, which on some level it is. It still is definitely that. But the way that Rabbi Weiss was able to reframe the ritual as, you know, being about anxiety, being about, you know, real human emotion that we can connect with and not just like vindictive misogyny, is a really, I think, valuable lesson. You know, even some of the uglier parts of our Torah, we can actually find ways to relate to.
Absolutely. And there was a piece in there that we didn't get to speak much about. And I know this was spoken about off recording, but that we talked about all men and women who have sinned in the community have the ability and the necessity to come forward and really apologize, to repent, and even pay for some of the damages that they may have caused. And what's really fascinating about that is in a parsha right after one that maybe leaves some people in the society out, in this particular society, it seems like people are being seen for who they are, and sometimes, yes, for who they're not, but that everybody has the ability to lift up their own message, their own tribute.
You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting that I didn't notice until my last read through of this Torah portion is that the offering in the ritual of the sota is described as minchat kena'ot, usually translated as an offering of jealousy. It can also be translated as an offering of passion or of zeal or just of like unbridled emotion. And I think it's really important to recognize that, like, these emotions that we're feeling are really complicated, that the people in our stories aren't two-dimensional. They're complex with really varied and intricate ideas and characters. And so I really love the way we framed this Torah portion around people bringing their individual gifts, their individual personalities, because we are each so complex, and our Torah not only allows for that, but really highlights it in so many ways.
I appreciate that, especially considering the fact that this episode is going to be released right after we celebrate the gift of Torah, right? The receiving of our Torah from Mount Sinai over the holiday of Shavuot. This plan of, you know, revelation of the text coming as a gift to our people and our ability to take ownership of it, yes, in our own terms and our own time, but also in the time of the people that came before us and looking towards the people who are going to come after us. We really hope that you enjoyed this particular episode as a gift in itself and that you continue to explore Torah and what it means to you whenever you come to it. That might look different each time you do come to a particular text that might be troubling, or if you have a podcast episode that you're listening to and you're like, wait a minute, what do those words mean again? I need to figure out that message for myself and how I might receive it and how I might relay it to others. For now, we're super glad that you're with us as we figure out our own meanings and our own messages that we're sharing with you. And of course, we wouldn't forget to lift up a glass to you this week. So we're raising our glasses to you, our listeners, and to you, also our teachers and our future rabbis. L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Rachel Pass, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And apparently, Amanda Weiss and I have hung out in many, many locations.